This is WJCT News 89.9 in Jacksonville. Opinions expressed on the First Coast Week in Review are those of our panelists and do not necessarily reflect the views of WJCT News 89.9.
Good morning. I'm Ann Schindler, and it's Friday, which means it's time for our First Coast Week in Review. Among our topics, a disgraced former public defender is disbarred, a verdict for one of two defendants in the JEA corruption trial, a former JAGS employee is sentenced for swindling the team out of $22 million, the NAACP urges Black college students to boycott Florida, and it's once again okay to say gay in the classroom. It's a full show, and here to talk about it, anchor and reporter at First Coast News, Jasmine Monroe. Good morning,
Hello.
Jazz.
Good morning, everyone.
First, Florida Times Union reporter Steve Patterson. Hi, Steve.
Good morning, Ann. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you. Attorney and former city council member of Jacksonville, Randy DeFore.
Good morning, Ann.
Good morning, Randy. And Andrew Pantazzi, investigative reporter and founder of The Tributary.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here. We also welcome you to join our conversation. Give us a call at 904-549-2937. Or you can send an email to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. You can also, of course, reach out on social media, Instagram, X, or Facebook. First up, I want to talk about former public defender Matt Shirk. He was formally disbarred Thursday, more than a decade after a political career that was engulfed and eventually extinguished by scandal. Andrew Pantazzi's reporting at the time prompted a series of criminal investigations, including by a grand jury, as well as investigations by the State Ethics Commission and the Auditor General. Andrew, I don't even know where to begin with this story. There is so much backstory, and much of it is frankly unbelievable.
Yeah, it's really incredible that Matt Shirk, the former public defender here in Jacksonville, how much every time he faced scandal would prompt deeper digging into him, which would prompt more scandal, which would then prompt more scandal. And it has become a cycle that still to this day hasn't ended, because 2 years ago, he had his law license suspended, and he decided while his law license was suspended that he felt like he could still practice law if he wanted to, because he said he couldn't find a lawyer to take over his cases. So what's he to do? He's going to just keep practicing law. Even when he has faced consequences, he has, with the Ethics Commission, he didn't pay the fine that they gave him, even after the governor ordered him to. He's just time and again been unable to accept the consequences of his actions.
Andrew, for those who may not know the backstory, the lead of your article announcing his disbarment sort of says it all. I'm just going to read it briefly. It says, Matt Shirk, a once promising Republican politician who squandered his chances at a political future when he hired women based on their physical appearance, propositioned them, fired them after his wife told him to, deleted public records, drank in the office, diverted campaign funds to his child's private school, violated the attorney-client privilege of a 12-year-old, paid his attorneys the lowest salaries in the state, gave away office guns to a motorcycle club without documenting it, and used the office's spending power to pay for lavish hotels. Some things aren't even in there, the bathroom that he built or the shower stall that he built. It really is a shock. Randy, I think people would be rightly surprised how much it took to get this guy out of office.
I'm totally with you on that. I mean, he really does give our profession a bad name. I mean, I think that the public defender's office under his leadership was basically Animal House. I mean, it was a disgrace.
And the governor had been asked at one point, Steve Patterson, to remove him from office, a recommendation from the Ethics Commission. He said, we're going to leave it to the voters. He was ultimately voted out. But he continued to practice law.
Well, the man's been very resilient, or at least very determined. You know, he has simply persisted, and probably should not have. He should have just seen the writing on the wall and said, okay, I am done.
Mm-hmm. Andrew, you've spent a lot of time, though, reporting on him over the years. Anything that you can share about the persistence his personality shows in these cases?
Yeah. So he ran for public defender in 2008 because he was fired from the public defender's office. And I think that is one of the first examples of his persistence. When he was not qualified enough to be an assistant public defender, he decided, I'm going to be the elected public defender. He never handled a murder case, never handled a complex criminal defense case before. But he ran in 2008, and nobody had ever actually challenged a public defender. historically, the legal community all decided who would be a good public defender, and nobody ever challenged whoever that was, going back to the beginning of elected public defenders in Florida. He ran in 2008 on a message of, I promise I will never question the integrity of a police officer. Later, he actually then would turn around and say, I question the integrity of every single police officer who I said I would never question the integrity of, because he claimed they were lying when he when they had him recorded saying that. He also ran on a message of, my opponent is going to vote for Barack Obama and I'm going to vote for John McCain, so that's why I should be the elected public defender. And then when he swept into office, he first thing he did is he gave a list of 10 lawyers he wanted to have fired. He misspelled the majority of their names in the document he gave, and he brought in a bunch of allies and friends and just very quickly started changing how the office is. I will also say, despite the two criminal grand juries and despite his own background, which is very wanting and very inadequate as a criminal defense attorney, he did know how to hire good criminal defense attorneys. He was able to avoid any criminal charges despite repeated criminal investigations into his behavior. And despite grand jury saying they believed he broke the law, but they did not recommend an indictment. And so he was at least able to hire for himself private attorneys who were very equipped and very adequate at keeping him out of jail.
Jasmine, you're probably fortunate as a reporter to have been not quite in this market when all of this was happening.
No, I'm so surprised. Everything he's saying, it's a laundry list of things. I was waiting for something good to come out, so I guess he knows how to get the right attorney.
For himself, yeah. That's right. I do think that one of the things he pointed out that was interesting is that he had pledged, you know, that he was never going to question an officer's integrity on the stand. And obviously, it's hard to provide a vigorous defense for your client if you're not going to challenge the official version. We know that it's not always the case that officers' versions are the most accurate version.
Right. I think it's always good to, of course, question both sides. But going into office saying that you're not going to do something and turn around and then have to do it, that's when, you know, you bite yourself, you know. So I think it's best to stay away from conversations like that, especially when you're running for something, because you can really back yourself into a corner.
Mm-hmm. Randy, one of the things that he also pledged to do when he was running for office was to check out and try to verify whether his clients were actually poor. Obviously, it's the job of the public defender to defend those who are indigent, right, and can't afford a defense. Is that even legal? Isn't that even a conflict of interest to try to investigate your own client?
I would assume so. Yes, it is. I mean, I think it's interesting. I had forgotten, Andrew, about the fact that it was really the political machine that put him into office, and that it had gone against the tradition of the attorney bar, if you will, determining who should be in that role. And it's nice to know that now with Charlie Cofer, we've really gone back to that. So, you know, Matt Shirk is a very, good looking man. He is, you know, he talks well in public. I mean, he's charming. I think that's why he's gotten away with this for so long.
Mm-hmm. Steve Patterson, one thing that is interesting about this is, you know, is Charlie Cofer. He is the current public defender. But before that, he was a circuit judge, and he basically had a pretty, you know, solid future as a judge. It's well paid. It's a lifetime position, essentially. I mean, you have to go through these sort of performative elections, but, you know, most people are reelected. He actually gave up his job as a judge because he was so outraged at what was happening in the office he had previously worked in. And so he quit and decided to run for office as public defender.
And I think that should give people some sense of comfort with the man they have running the office now. I mean, if you need the public defender's office as your to represent you, it's good to know that there's a person in charge there who simply feels called to do this. Mm-hmm. So
I also think one of the funny things about when Cofer ran in 2016 is, like, his campaign was very clearly a, like, make the public defenders boring again. It was like, my goal is to not be written about if I get elected. It was just a very simple, nothing fancy, not having to make the same promises of, like, I'm never going to question the integrity of police. It was just we're just going to make the public defenders like it used to be, like something that most people are not aware who the elected public defender is.
Yeah. And I think you pointed out in your reporting, you know, Charlie answers his calls. He handles his own press inquiries, unlike Shirk, who actually had two really high paid public, what do you call them? Public information officer.
Yeah, he was the only, I talked to every single public defender in the state, and out of the 20 public defenders, only one had a PIO and he had two. He had two spokesmen who each were paid about double the median salary for attorneys, neither of whom were attorneys, and one of whom did not show up to work for 3 months, yet, by golly, he was at every single campaign event. And so it was very clear that was just another one of the things that he was doing, is employing people who clearly were working on his campaign full time and not working in the office.
Well, I think it just speaks to the value of investigative journalism, Andrew, and I think we're all grateful for the great work that you did, because really you are largely responsible for all of this coming to light.
Well, I do want to shout out Topher Sanders, who used to be at the Times Union, who broke the first initial stories on this, which opened up the, again, every time you start digging a little deeper, finding out just how much more there was there.
Topher was an incredible, incredible reporter. We're talking about the top stories of the week with our panel of journalists, and you are welcome to join our conversation. Give us a call at 904-549-2937 or email us at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. All right, I want to move on now to JEA. A verdict has been reached in the criminal case against one of the two former executives of the city-owned utility. That verdict is against former CEO Aaron Zahn, but it's currently sealed, Randy. The judge says he wants to wait until the jury in his co-defendant's case, there's two juries in this case,
right,
comes back and brings their verdict for Ryan Wanamaker. So in addition to being a lawyer, you're a former city council
right.
member, you led that special investigative committee.
I was on it. Mm-hmm. Brenda Priestley-Jackson led it. I actually have a copy with me today. I got up at 3:30 this morning and reread the whole thing just because I just couldn't stop thinking about it. But yes, it is, I really believe that the work of the city council is what brought this to fruition.
Mm-hmm. And the work of the city council, do you feel like this is the end of the road? Are you have any feeling about how this case is going to come out?
I don't. You know, you never should judge a jury. I mean, you really should not. You know, we respect the juries, and we need to wait for the jury to speak for itself.
Mm-hmm. What kind of outcome are you hoping for?
Well, I'm hoping for a verdict of guilty.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of resolution will that bring to you or to the city?
Well, I think that it sends a very strong message that we absolutely must have transparency in government.
Mm-hmm.
Because if we don't, you know, the saying is, and it was in our report, if we don't have transparency in government, it just breeds mischief.
Mm-hmm.
And so we, you know, I think that we can't, I really believe that these people thought they could come to Jacksonville and that we were some southern redneck town that they could take advantage of, and disrespected us in many, many ways.
It's surprising though, Randy. I mean, when you look back at it, and the case really reminds you as you're sitting of some of that through the in a presentation of the evidence, how close this came to becoming reality.
Close.
I mean, there was, you know, documents ready to be signed. This, FPNL was basically poised to take it over.
Right.
This crazy, you know, exorbitant retirement, plan, benefit
right.
plan was in place.
I had people telling me, you know, that it was a done deal and that, you know, I should just get on the bus.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I could not face my children. And not, again, if I didn't fight against this. It was a miracle that this was stopped.
What kind of pressures did you face in office to approve this?
Oh, huge pressures.
Explain what that's like for people who don't know.
Well, you know, you have lobbyists that are constantly in your office. You have politics of people, you know, fighting your fear. The fear is that you'll never be able to get any legislation passed in the future because you're running up against, in that case, the administration.
Is that explicit or implicit?
It's pretty explicit.
Yeah.
I had people screaming at me, telling me that, you know, that I was crazy. The pressure is undeniable. It was undeniable. And that's why I look at some of my other councilmen who stood up as I did. And it's just, you know, look, and the people before, look at Anna Brochet. I mean, look what they did to her.
Former city council president.
Yes.
Challenged the mayor,
correct.
Mayor Curry, in election. Mm-hmm.
And,
people don't maybe remember what.
Well, when she ran for office and how they just, oh God, they just slaughtered her character. And she's probably one of the finest people anyone knows. And, you know, they were going to do anything they could to get the sale to occur.
Yeah. So Brochet, of course, is in the Deegan administration right now as the CFO. Steve, when we talk about a done deal, I mean, she says people were telling her it was a done deal towards the end. I think there was a lot of people at the beginning that thought it was a done deal just because it's sort of the way business is done in Jacksonville.
The thing that this done deal point of view doesn't take into consideration, though, was the extent to which there was a popular feel that this utility was a public asset, and it was something that you know people felt very very invested in, and I think the number of JEA adherents, the people who were part of the JEA is ours movement, the way those folks just kept showing up and writing letters and calling TV stations and so forth, I think that just became awkward for the folks who would have liked this to move the way so many political decisions move.
Steve, you're in federal court a lot. I see you there frequently. You cover a lot of white-collar crime. Those are tough cases to cover. They're tough cases for juries. What are some of the challenges in presenting a case like this?
The simplest thing that the prosecutor needs to achieve is to get through the details of the case, the things that you need to be able to show for the record that you have laid out to the jury, to show a factual basis was presented, and then the jury can go back in and reach its conclusion and won't be subject to a valid appeal. But if you need to do that, but at the same time, not have the jurors' eyes glaze over. And if you can do this and make the jury feel like, okay, I understand that, and this is not that hard to decide, and this is how I'm going, then you're done.
Mm-hmm. Jasmine, we're mentioning just kind of difficulty in covering this case. It's nearing an end, but this has been some 4 weeks of covering a case where there's no cameras in court, there's no audio, there's no recording of any kind. How do you tell this story?
So for me personally, we are working really closely with Renata DiGregorio. She's an amazing investigative reporter for First Coast News, just listening and, you know, painting the picture for people. I think oftentimes people hear stories like this and they don't pay attention to it. They don't know how serious it is. But just like you said, Randy, it's, you know, the wool pulling over your eyes. You want to pay attention to small things. It's not small, it's big, but it's something like this. If they could get away with this, what is next? I think that's the thing that people don't tend to think about when it comes to the decision making of the city and JEA. I also talked to Randy, working in Cleveland Public Power. It's not so much similar to this, but getting away with, you know, charging customers more money and they lost that lawsuit. It's things like that you don't realize how important journalism is. And folks at home, if you're listening in your car, support your journalists, support those people going to those court meetings, because you can't do it. You're at work. You know, we're working as hard as we can to get both sides of the story, to make sure you know exactly what's happening, because you're sending your kids off to school. You're going to work and you have to handle your life. But this is, you know, work for us. And, you know, we truly stand beside what we do, the work that we do, how hard we work when it comes to stories that make a difference in your life. You wake up the next day and your life changes.
Mm-hmm. Andrew, are people still questioning the role of other people around just these two that are charged? Will people be satisfied, you know, with the resolution of this case kind of wrapping up the entire years-long scandal?
Yeah, I think for the public and for us as journalists, we have to remember that there's a difference between what is a criminal conviction and what is still true but may not be a crime.
Mm-hmm.
The level that you have to reach in order to prove federal corruption charges has just been raised again and again by the U.S. Supreme Court as they've made it more and more difficult to bring these types of cases. Throughout this case, what we've seen in the reporting from the people who've been in the courtroom is that it was not limited to the two men who faced charges. People who were connected with Mayor Curry were very much implicated, not in crimes, but in some pretty egregious behavior. You know, there were a lot of people who testified about being threatened and being told, if you don't go along with this, just like former Councilwoman DeFore was just saying, if you don't go along with this, we are going to make your life very difficult. What was painted as a picture of the previous administration is one that bullied people into submission, one that was not willing to accept no for an answer, and one that was going to steamroll anyone who gets in the way. And I think what we also saw was from some of the former board members, a lack of due diligence, as they described going along with the plan without questioning. Ironically, one of whom was at the time the Jaguar CFO. And I think we're going to talk about the Jaguars also not having good measures in place to monitor themselves. But I think that we saw what happens when people instinctively go into their tribal corners, and how easily it is for corruption to flourish. And so people should take a lesson from this, that regardless of whether they're convicted or not, what came out at trial is the dangers that happens whenever you go into a tribal corner that says, I'm going to support my Democrat, I'm going to support my Republican, I'm going to support the person who I'm aligned with no matter what, and I'm not going to question whether they may have ulterior motives or that I'm trying to benefit myself with this plan.
And Randy, of course, you are a Republican.
I am.
And so, the pressures that you felt were coming from within your own party.
Absolutely. Well, I say that. The majority of the Republican Party was opposed to the sale of the JEA. So it wasn't the Republican Party, but it certainly was some very strong people in the Republican Party that were for it. You know, I was remiss in not doing a shout out to the journalists. We could not have stopped us without journalism. It just could not have happened. So I just want to thank all of you that were a part of that. And it is important to support, you know, it really is important that everyone out there that's listening to this support those who are trying to get the news out in a very, you know, honest manner.
I wonder if it's changed at all, you know, the makeup of these boards going forward. I mean, a lot of the trial that I've been there for, you have these board members who are testifying. They're playing clips from these meetings where they were making these consequential decisions. And I mean, all I can think is it just must be mortifying because they're on, you know, at these meetings, they're kind of grandstanding and pontificating about the challenges ahead and how they're going to take, you know, a step towards making a really important decision. And this is going to be a landmark moment. And I don't think any of them anticipated that all of that was going to be true, but sort of in the not a way that they would have enjoyed.
Right. And please remember that they did not receive their packet before that board meeting until the night before. And it literally was almost a foot deep. I mean, it was huge. And so, you know, I think some of the testimony was like, to the general counsel, I think Lynn Rohde, they asked Lynn Rohde, could any of the board members talk to you about what was in the packet? And they could have, but they didn't have time. There was no time. This was all created in such a manner that was intentional, that it was not going to be honest or truthful. This was, they were set up. So I give them a little more break, Andrew, than you, because, you know, they trusted these people. The board members trusted the heads of the JEA. They did. And they were misled.
Yeah. Well, I mean, to be clear, I think that the information that they got shortly before the meeting that they didn't know about previously was the performance unit plan. But
right.
The sale issue, which they've all kind of fell in line with, had been a matter of discussion for years.
And I'll say the reporting at the time by the Times Union, my former colleagues, Nate Monroe, David Bauerline, Chris Hong, were continually reporting about how JEA claimed they were in a death spiral. They claimed that JEA is going to collapse at any moment. We must urgently do something. And there was no evidence to back that up. And JEA buckled down so much, they sent out to ratepayers little mailers basically refuting that the Times Union is lying to you and don't trust this, that like we are in a death spiral and we need to do something quickly. And I think that the board in particular was also pretty defensive about, you know, reporting that is indicating JEA might be lying. And again, that's sometimes the tribal corners we go to are not even political parties, but, you know, we can do this with our football teams, with anything where it's just like, oh, you're insulting me. You're saying I might be lying. And it's like, no, I'm saying the organization you're with might not be telling the whole truth. And to be willing to accept that and question the people who are in your in-group and say, actually maybe the whole basis for this sale, which is JEA is going to collapse at any moment if we don't sell. Let's actually look at the numbers and see if there's any basis for that, because that seems really awful convenient for people who already want to privatize.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, they did provide numbers. They lied about the numbers. So it was a huge marketing campaign.
Yeah.
I mean, really. So it's a miracle that it got stopped.
Well, I do want to talk about football, Steve Patterson. So this was a story that you reported in December. And then recently, the gentleman at the center of the case was sentenced. But this is a fraud amount. It's less than JEA, but it's $22 million that this former finance manager for the Jacksonville Jaguars embezzled. Remind us how this fraud was discovered and kind of how it was the money was spent.
The fraud was actually it was discovered essentially because someone looked at the team's bank accounts and said, "Oh, well, this doesn't look like what our records say the money went to." There was a gentleman, Amit Patel, who had developed a gambling problem and had realized that he was handling a spending system, what they call the virtual credit card system, for staff there, and he was simply taking money from this virtual credit card system, which is a bank account, and using it for his gambling debts and other purposes, other personal purposes, and no one was backstopping him. No one was checking whether what he was doing looked like what he was reporting,
mm-hmm.
and so he ended up, over the course of 3 years and change, misusing roughly $22 million. And wow. So
he could have faced up to 30 years. Jasmine, he got a little over six. He has to pay back more than $21 million in theory. But this case got a lot of attention just because of the lavish spending involved. Remind us a little bit about what he was, in addition to being, I guess, a pretty bad gambler, he was also spending a lot of money on personal items.
Yeah, I believe that I read that there were several opportunities of him at the spa, a car, or I think it was a golf club from Tiger Woods or something. I don't want to misconstrue. Right. But, I mean, he was living the life. And he said that he had a gambling problem. But, you know, how bad do you feel after shopping? You know, it's what do they call it? I can't forget. I'm forgetting what they call it. You know, it's your guilty
like
pleasure.
Retail therapy.
Yeah, it's retail therapy.
This is pretty high
end
therapy.
Yeah, this is high end therapy. But you know, just reading the comments of what people have to say, especially the Jaguars fans, they went in on him,
mm-hmm.
Just saying, you know, he just lived his best life, and they don't believe he had a gambling problem. I think this goes to show that even with your financial, like, you know, you file your taxes, just double check people's work. You can't truly trust a person to handle that amount of money and honestly believe that they're you know, going to handle it with care.
Yeah, it's surprising that there was nobody there sort of double checking his work, that he was really the sole authority over these.
I think they will now.
Accounts.
Well,
one of the things that was interesting in this when we got to sentencing was this week. There was he ended up being sentenced to 6.5 years in prison. And part of that was based on a point system that ups your penalty if you're doing a crime that is especially complex. And his attorney was arguing to the judge beforehand that, "Judge, this really was not a particularly complex crime. It was just something that was real simple that my client just did hundreds of times." And so that was in a way sort of galling that a person could come up there and argue that. The judge was not convinced. He ultimately said, "Look, it involved a spreadsheet. The man had to take like 30, 45 minutes to rejuggle the numbers to make them look right each time. it's complex enough to meet the threshold for the additional penalty.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's so fascinating to have this case come at a time when the Jaguars are saying they need $1 billion in taxpayer money that we should trust them to handle and that they'll be able to handle really well. To know that when we look deeper into this, the issue was they decided we could cut expenses by not having someone back check the numbers. And that really does speak to, is this an organization that can be entrusted with $1 billion extra dollars to manage for constructing an entertainment district or a new stadium? And how much do the citizens need as we go into these negotiations? How much do we need more assurances that the Jaguars, who we've learned can fumble things even more greater than a football on a football field, that we need more assurances that they've made some changes and that it's not going to be the same type of organization that, oh, well, we misplaced $22 million. Oops.
Mm-hmm. That was a question that someone actually emailed into the station. What happens next? You know, he receives this, you know, verdict, the guilty. He's guilty for this. But what happens next? You have to kind of let fans know, you know, where this money's going, where your investors' money is going. Is there a new person in this seat? And who that person is.
Mm-hmm. And not just the investors' money. I mean, this is like people should recognize this is season ticket holders' money. This is Jaguars fans' money that went $22 million out the door rather than investing back into the team, rather than going into a better fan experience at the game. It went to one person because they did not put in the necessary controls in order to be able to catch something like this. And now they're saying, hey, look at our stadium. We need a new stadium. And it's like, well, maybe if you had $22 million that went back into maintenance at the stadium, it would be a little bit better today. But instead, they didn't have those controls. So they need the taxpayers to come in and offer them extra money to build this entertainment district.
Randy, is there a reason to think that that might actually enter the conversation, the negotiations, this accounting failure?
I don't think so. I mean, look, they need to work on their auditing, obviously. One of the things that he did pay for, which I thought was interesting, was $275,000 for to hire an attorney. So he knew it was coming out of those funds. But just to go. That's
just smart.
I mean,
pay that first and then, you know, give back the rest of the money.
The truth of the matter is on this stadium deal, we're going to need to have serious controls from a city's perspective, making sure that the money is used for what its intended purpose. One of the problems we had with the amphitheater was that, if you recall, like just what they were going to build, it didn't end up looking anything like the original plans because supposedly in the contract or the it was not specifically stated that they had to build this amphitheater that looks like this, right? The thing that had been portrayed is what we were funding.
Right. So Daly's Place in its original renderings looked pretty
very
elegant.
Different. Mm-hmm. Yeah, very. So I would hope that we would learn from that and make sure that every I is dotted and every T is crossed to ensure that we know exactly where the money's going and we know exactly the product we're getting.
Mm-hmm. We are talking about the big headlines of the week. We're going to move on to talk about a suggested boycott by Black athletes in the state of Florida. But you're welcome to join our conversation. Give us a call at 904-549-2937. You can tag us on X at FCC on Air. You can email First Coast Connect at WJCT.org. And you can message us on the First Coast Connect Facebook and Instagram pages. All right, Jasmine, Black student athletes should reconsider attending Florida's public universities and colleges in light of the state's ongoing diversity, equity, and inclusion issues. That's according to a warning Monday from the NAACP. And it comes after the state basically dismantled its DEI programs at some of the most competitive and prestigious schools in the state. Talk about what prompted this letter from the NAACP and what it said.
I think for the most part, when it comes down to it, Governor DeSantis is sending a message and the NAACP is sending a message back. They already said telling Black people in general to be careful coming down to Florida. Messages that I even received, you know, I'm a recent new Floridian to coming to this city of, are you okay? Do you feel safe living here in this area? And it's so unfortunate because Florida is such a great state for me, you know, living here, things to do, activities. But, you know, to pull away DEI from a school district, that is a safe haven for Black students. That's a program that I was a part of. I'm a part of Alpha Kappa Alpha Sorority Incorporated. It's a predominantly Black sorority. Not funding those things. Those are the areas, those are the people that Black students and white and Asian go to talk to have a safe area to express how they feel about a professor or a program that they want to start or something that happened to them. If you don't have someone who looks like you at the university that you're spending thousands of dollars to go to, that's a red flag. You shouldn't be investing. That's my personal view. You know, not the station's view. I want to make sure that's clear. But, you know, when you think about it, it's just unfortunate, you know, to just think, you know, your students can't go to college. I see these recruiters go into predominantly Black communities and take these kids out of these communities and put them at the FSUs and these big universities to not support them. You know, what type of support will they have? Because without DEI, you kind of can't look at a professor and expect them to know what you've been through. If you grew up in the hood, is what they call it.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's interesting that this suggestion of a boycott, Steve, comes directed at specifically at athletes in Florida that might be looking at some of these schools, particularly FSU and UNF, which are not only prestigious schools, but make a huge amount of money from their athletic program. The letter, you know, is saying that they should not be attending these schools because of DEI. But that really could have an impact on those schools' bottom line.
Oh, there's no question it will have an impact on bottom lines for athletic programs and certainly for visibility of some athletic programs, and it will impact, you know, the public perceptions of the teams. This is also, I gotta say, the perfect time for this, as you know, young people are making their decisions about what colleges to attend for the coming year, but it's also not at all, shouldn't be in any way surprising that the NAACP did this, because this concern about Florida's approach to race is something that has been bubbling for a very extended time. You know, we had last fall, we had a national conference here, Association for Study of African American Life and History. We had people who came to Jacksonville from around the country, basically to say we're concerned about how we can teach African American history and how we can talk about this and make ourselves understood, and we think the state of Florida does not get it.
Just for context, in terms of financial impact, so Florida's home to two of the largest athletic departments in the nation. That's at UF and FSU. They're both in the rank in the nation's top 15 programs in terms of total revenue, and the NAACP says that 9 of the state's public universities have Division I teams, and that they are more than half historically they're Black, mm-hmm. you know, athletes that are in those programs. And so making that appeal, Randy, is really going to be, you know, it's a financial message to the governor. Do you think that's
totally
one that he'll respond to?
It's we're going to hit your pocketbook. Mm-hmm. I would hope so. You know, because if you don't have a successful sports team, you don't get the TV endorsements. You don't. It's a huge financial impact, negative impact. So I would be hopeful. I am hopeful that the governor will respond.
Mm-hmm.
Not to mention, right now, there are certain school districts that are pushing for Black students to go to predominantly Black schools, HBCUs. So when it comes to FAMU and FSU, more students are going to be looking at those private schools to send their kids. Deion Sanders talked about it, and then all of a sudden went the other side. But
it's interesting. I think that Florida A&M is one of the schools that the NAACP yeah. exempted from this
yes,
recommendation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Andrew.
Well, I was going to say I don't want to suggest in any possible way that I'm implying the NCAA has any integrity, but the NCAA does have within their constitution a requirement that in order to participate in Division I sports, you must encourage DEI and you must conduct a DEI review every 4 years. And so now, as I said, I'm not going to suggest the NCAA would ever enforce its rules fairly and equitably to schools that bring in a lot of revenue. But if it were, if the NCAA said the rules that we have are actual rules that we're actually going to enforce, I don't understand how Florida or Alabama or other states that are banning DEI or banning state funding on DEI could still participate in the NCAA at all. Again, we're talking about the NCAA, one of the few organizations that make the mafia look like they're, you know, good choir boys. But if they were to actually enforce their rules fairly, I don't even understand how the schools can participate in any NCAA sports.
I want to take a call. Stanley, on the north side. Good morning, Stanley. Give us your opinion.
Yes, good morning to everybody, especially my good friend, DeFore. Great job you're doing with the city indirectly. But my main concern here, I support the NAACP on the surface, but my main concern here when it comes to African American education, my main concern is the fact that African Americans, I'm talking about the leadership, is not talking about education, because there's two types of education. There's one that teach you how to maintain a job or a career, and the most important one is how to live. When it comes to education, when it comes to African American history, we are complacent. We are not really advocating, I'm talking about African American, for African American education. Thank you.
Thank you, Stanley. This issue actually kind of dovetails with another one that made headlines this week. That's Florida's Don't Say Gay Act. We've heard a lot of stories of people in the LGBTQ community, whether they're college kids considering coming to Florida or families considering leaving Florida, that, you know, the laws that have been impacting and restricting discussions of, you know, things that are related to LGBTQ issues, or bills that have targeted trans athletes, that there've been a kind of climate of hostility. Andrew, remind us what this Don't Say Gay Act provided for and what this new legal settlement will allow.
Yeah, so the parental rights and education law that was signed 2 years ago and then expanded upon last year prohibited classroom instruction of sexual orientation and gender identity. And it was very vague as to what does that mean? What is classroom instruction? What is sexual orientation? Like, what are you defining with these terms? And there were a lot of threats made to school districts, and school districts took very strict interpretations where they said, okay, we're going to make sure there are no books that mention anyone who's gay. We're going to make sure that we remove all rainbow stickers from classrooms. We're going to remove safe spaces from our schools that were created. We're going to stop student-led organizations for Gay Straight Alliance. You know, we're going to limit PFLAG, the Parents and Friends of Lesbian and Gay Students. There were a lot of really strict, onerous rules that came out, and they came out from the districts who are trying to interpret a very vague law that the State Department of Education was giving very little instruction on. And so what this lawsuit does is this lawsuit says, we're going to now clarify that while you can't have any instruction in this way, you can have library books, you can have students are allowed to, you know, wear a rainbow shirt, like trying to limit some of the reactions that districts have done. And the governor and his allies are taking this up as a win, saying, look, see, you all overreacted. You all lied about what the law did.
The law is still in place.
When in fact, it was just that the law was vague. And no one knew how the law was going to be enforced. And so then the LGBTQ activists who brought the lawsuit are also taking this up as a win that finally schools are going to be able to have more programming again to help students to feel welcomed who either have gay or lesbian parents or who are gay or lesbian themselves.
Yeah, and I've heard, Randy, that that's the very definition of a chilling effect, is that it prevents people from talking about what they are, you know, want to talk about because they're worried about consequences because they don't understand.
Right. And I think they were concerned about even criminal repercussions if they didn't follow the law. And you know, I think that, you know, it's good that this has been clarified that students can talk about their sexuality with their teachers. It's just a product of this gender ideology that the DeSantis administration has been addressing. But students need to be able to talk in a healthy manner.
Mm-hmm. We've got very short time now for our lightning round. We're going to do a lightning round. Jasmine, what's cooking?
Oh, my goodness. I'm learning golf, you all.
Hey, great.
So I'm going to head out to the PGA Tour. Hopefully I can make it through all the traffic.
Wonderful. Steve, what are you working on?
I'm working on stuff that will be in the paper next week or after that. But I did notice something that just struck me as interesting locally, and that is my paper's parent company has USA Today, and they produced a list of the best beer cities in America, and Jacksonville is number 6.
Hey.
And so I thought, well,
beat out Indianapolis.
I'll raise a glass to that.
Right, yeah. Fantastic. What are you working on?
I am working on making it through spring break, which began today with my kids who are in the studio with us. And so I am going to enjoy the next week having extra time with them.
Bon courage. How about you, Randy?
DPC all the way.
All right. And I just want to note, it's always good to go to a library book sale. Books are cheap, lots on available. But there is actually a book that was found recently at one of these that was hollowed out, had a safe, and was full of jewelry. So you never know. There is a book sale on University Boulevard at their bookstore, or at their library today and tomorrow, so worth checking out.
And promises you will get jewelry.
That's right. Thanks so much to all of you for being here. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we'll be up next with a local bottle shop celebrating 9 years in the business.
Wayne Hogan of the Terrell Hogan Personal Injury and Wrongful Death Law Firm. Serious injury cases are complex, and civil trial attorneys present the evidence juries need to see and hear. More at waynehogan.law.
So you've never donated to the station before. That's okay. Today is a great day to make your first gift. Here's how.
Please call 904-353-9528 or visit us at wjct.org/radio.
What's next for TikTok? The election rematch is now official. Joe Biden and Donald Trump secure enough delegates to be their respective party's nominee. Plus,
I did not sanitize my explanation. Nor did I disparage the president unfairly.
Former special counsel Robert Hur defends his decision to question the president's memory. That and much more on the Friday News Roundup next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. The beloved tasting room and bottle shop in the heart of Five Points, Alewife, marks its 9th anniversary next week. They're celebrating with a lineup of events ranging from an Italian cooking class to a book fair. And I'm joined now by owner and CEO Kelly Pickard. Welcome back to the program.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
I'm glad to have you. So 9 years is huge, quite a feat.
It simultaneously feels like it was yesterday and also feels like it's been 20 years. Uh-huh. So
what kind of changes have you seen in the industry and in your own shop since you started?
Oh, man. So much has changed in 9 years from kind of an industry, between changes in the industry, between existing post-COVID, to just neighborhood dynamics being different. I think at the heart, probably some of the biggest changes we've seen, I've heard conversations about it, but are within the beer industry. We opened at kind of the peak of craft beer and that scene, and we've kind of had to weather how that has changed. It used to be when we first opened and you'd have an event, somebody would release a new beer and that's all you needed to pack out the place. But now we're in a situation, both good, and also challenging, is that we have access to, more new beer than we can bring in mm-hmm. every week. There's more new product, coming out, than what you can even, stock. But so it's less about the beer and more about the space that you're creating. Some of the original advice we got was has helped us along the way.
In terms of creating a space that is welcoming.
Yeah, it was one of the original kind of, we had somebody that we knew in the industry that had opened a bottle shop in North Carolina, and he had talked to us about, you know, it's people who love beer, they're fickle. They'll follow the beer. And he was like, what you want to do is create a space for the people that are going to be in your community, the ones that are going to be that are going to celebrate milestones, that are going to come in every day. And I'm really glad we got that advice and kind of stuck with that, because then you can pivot and you can make changes, but still staying who you are and still offering. I mean, the beer is what we do, but the space is who we are.
And so how is the business, is the industry itself contracting right now, or is it still as growing as it?
It's hard to say. I can't speak to like the experience that breweries are having, but I know there have been conversations about, you know, local closings. And I think for us, what we've seen is just there's more choices than ever. And we're also seeing not so much just a focus on what we would call craft beer, but there's been emerging markets. We've seen more interest in cider, in mead, in CBD beverages, and not legal here yet, but THC beverages and natural wine and all sorts of movements. And we have a growing, growing sober clientele. And we're seeing emerging kind of better options from non-alcoholic beer and other NA beverages. And I think it's just
interesting.
I think that's allowed us to create a space for, I feel like our focus has almost gotten wider. It's more about how do we keep a space that allows more and more people to keep coming in, rather than just focusing just on, you know, the newest beer that's coming out, the hypest beer that's coming out. How can we offer as many of the beverages that are out there to create a space for as many people as possible?
I love that mead is making a comeback after a thousand years or whatever.
Yeah, no, it's wild. The number of people that come in, I think we had been open for maybe 2 or 3 years when we kind of changed our window signage and added the cider and mead section. And the number of people that we have come in that are just like, I've heard of mead, but they don't know what it is, but they know they want to try it. And that's been a huge growth market for us, is our addition of cider and mead. In 2016, we added additional taps so that we could keep cider and mead on tap on a consistent basis. So that's been a huge, huge segment.
Yeah. And how about, is the post-COVID recovery done? Or does it continue?
I don't think it's done. I mean, I can only speak from my experience, but I think there's just so many little things that have changed. So I don't know if it ever finishes. It just sort of adapts. We've seen that. I still think people's behaviors going out have shifted. I don't think people go out as much. I know for myself, I don't. I think a lot of people during COVID invested in their homes, made them places that they want to be. I think the impact of not people, of businesses not fully going back to office culture, has impacted everything from restaurants and their lunch offerings to the happy hour segment. So I think there's lots of little changes that we all sort of keep weathering, and not to undermine the fact that that's just a huge hole that we all had to dig out of. And just because you made it through those impacts of trying to, you know, pay back that debt, to all the kind of help that we got to get us through, it wasn't all free. You know, we do have to pay some of that back. So it just, I think they linger, and you just kind of have to try to adapt to it.
Well, let's talk about the party.
Yeah, let's do it.
9th anniversary, and I understand that there's a number of things planned. There's a cooking class on Tuesday, Italian cooking.
Yeah, so there's, and I mean, that's part of the growth too, is as a space, again, it can't just be about, that's one of the industry changes we've seen too, whether you're a bottle shop or a brewery, it's not enough just to offer the beer anymore. You've got to offer and experience things for people to do. So we have a number of events. The events this week are indicative of some of the ones we have always, but Italian cooking class on Tuesday. Bring in back vino and vinyl on Wednesday.
People can bring their own records.
You can bring it. Buckley from Coast to Coast Records will be spinning as well. The big party on Thursday is just good beer, good people,
and and a beer chug
and me
on
getting
Thursday.
To be on the other side of the bar and hugging everyone that's showing up.
Well, congratulations, Kelly Pickard. Thanks so much for being here. And
no,
good luck
thank you
week.
For having me.
Happy birthday.
Yeah, thanks.
All right, and we're going to give away a couple of tickets today, actually, to an Eagles tribute show, Hotel California. It's at the Florida Theater, Saturday, March 23rd. All you have to do is email firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Just put tickets in the subject header. And that's our program. Join us again Monday when we talk to the architects of the Emerald Trail about a new infusion of federal dollars. I'm Ann Schindler. You've been listening to First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.